Mr. Coley, Rail 9. After leaving Camp Casey, early 1953, I think, is about the time are we talking about?
Yes, it would be springtime.
And after leaving Camp Casey, you went to 355. Oh, now, what was it like? Can you describe that position to me?
Very good. Very good. Very steep. Nothing happened. Apart from seeing patrols in and out, we didn't do much at all. Yeah, the tanks were further down, and I think they had the worst time than us. They were further down the hill. It was a dead position. That's the dead position. I can't remember what was happening there that day.
And how did the trench lines or whatever, where were they situated on such a steep hill?
It was, they were dug into the hill, straight down into the hill. And then you looked out, and you were looking down sort of the cliff face. And then probably 20 yards further up there would be another line, and a set of steps between them. But a terrible position, I thought. And the hutch that we were in wasn't great either, because we were on the rocky side of the hill. It couldn't go very far, because of the steepness. Sort of a dead position.
Where were the Chinese in relation to, or the enemy, I should say, in relation to your position?
They were over the top of the 355 to the front of our camp. Was it 220? Chinese position? But we couldn't see 220 from there. We couldn't see any.
So they were basically out of sight?
They were out of sight, yeah. We couldn't fire it because we couldn't set the guns up for anything. It was just a dead war. And the sooner we got off there, the better we liked it.
And when you say dead, it wasn't very active, was it? Is that what you're saying?
No activity at all. Apart from the doors going out. But the Americans were there, and it was a funny position. I mean, we had a couple of Americans next to us. And they had a funny trip. They would go on patrol as their children, don't they? One of the things I remember about it, they're all very, very dark colored negroes. And at night, the only thing you could see were the teeth. If you smiled, you could see the teeth. And you'd be walking along and bump into one, you didn't know he was there.
When you say mixed up, they weren't actually mixed up within your own.
It's sort of a tradition, maybe. 100 yards below us, and we were through that. But you could hear them, and
were they noisy at night, the Americans, weren't they?
Oh, yes, no. Yeah. If you didn't keep them quiet, they were quiet there because we kept them quiet. But the American positions, you could land around the horn with them, and flashing lights, and with a light cigarette in there, and no wonder you got a tank. I don't know what that told you about the military.
Oh yes, we've got that on the previous tape. So this was basically, as you say, quiet and rather dull position. Have you any other memories of the time that you were on there, the very first time you were on there?
Just the young officer that was wanted for the stick.
This was the wooden grave that you described earlier. Quite a number of men, probably more than in an action situation, being killed or wounded with mines and things like that. Do you recall any ones close to yourselves that was killed?
On that position, yes, there was an American. The flare used to go at night, and was flare parachutes were about 6 foot across, or 3 yards. And one man from the minefield there. And we distracted him all and weren't bothered about it because the American decided that he wanted that parachute.
Yeah, I think we've got this tale as well on there.
That was that position there. And that was just at the anti-tank position.
And your role now as a sergeant, did that mean more responsibilities for you? Within the machine gun?
It's just a matter of, I still have the same section.
But just a higher rank, but the same section, and the same responsibilities. Was it still a night-time activity for you, 1355?
Yes, totally night-time.
But you weren't, I think you said you weren't firing.
We didn't fire the gate up there. It was just impossible because there's nothing to fire at. And the hill was so steep that we couldn't get over the top. We were more or less like a rifle.
In that situation, since you weren't acting or not firing so much, and yet you were always on a night duty. Why was the reason for that?
Because we were used to it. We were used to it. So we were on a night duty all the time. And that way we would face telephones, listen to posts, and things like that.
Whilst on that position, wasn't there some celebration of the Queen's coronation? That came along after this. Well, we haven't reached that point. Anything about this first occasion then, that you recall?
As I say, no, because I can't remember much about it, because it was so pleased. The recollection is, I don't know whether you've been told about 355, there was a sort of a nick in the railway that had been built by the engineers to go to the steep backside of it, and that was just behind us. And that used to take supplies to the top, or to bring anything down, just to come down. And that was just behind us. So I'll tell you how steep it was. We were right on this vernacular railway, and just at the top. And there were stairs down the side of it, so we put out steps. So it was like going up the roof.
Was it safe to move around in daylight?
On that position, pretty safe, yeah.
You weren't tied to...
No, we weren't tied to cover anyway. As I said, we weren't facing the enemy at all. A reserve dead.
And you said then you came off. Was that again for a brief rest or change?
Yes, we came off. I forget where. I think we went straight back on the 355. But the second time, my section got up right at the top, right at the peak. And from there, we commanded the whole of the foot. And that was a very good position. And you mentioned about the celebration while you were there. It was the coronation, I think, of the Queen in 1953. And one of our patrols went out, and things are used for aircraft recognition on the ground, the big strips. They put E2R on the closing Chinese here, with these big strips and left them at night. And the next morning, just E2R right across this Chinese here, and these big yellow and red strips. And the bugle went on the top where the flag was, the Union Jack and blue call. And he was in full view all the time. I think it was pretty foolish, but he did it. We were right on that top. When you see that little pimple on the top, that's where my section was.
And were you more active up there?
Oh, yes. Every night we were up there. And, we didn't get any shells up there.
What are your memories of it?
My memories was the two guns were either side of me. I was in a section here looking out over the top of the trench, waiting, timing. We had to wait and we were on standby, 72 hours. 72 hours standby. Remember that in the night of the attack, I was so tired, you weren't allowed, you know, any rest. today. Fell forward in the trench and hit the head on the front and got to sleep on the feet. And then when the attack went in, it was chaos. We were failing and didn't get coming really just in support. But I remember the whole thing, I don't know whether it was successful, I can't remember. They didn't capture it, and they just attacked and then withdrew. And they brought up to some of that. Marine was certainly from under that.
And was this a night attack?
Yes.
Were you firing on fixed lines in support?
We were given fixed lines on their positions, and that was it. We just blanketed that. Not only my section, but other sections that was going to help. There would be eight guns on that. We just blanketed the whole of the hill where we knew our lads weren't doing. And we fired at that point. I think there's three battlefields then. And everything was to get back into our own position for the next night. We weren't having any rest, we just straight back up and set them up again and fire the next night.
Fixed lines, I know basically what it means. You have a target and you just hit it.
Yeah.
And you lock the gun under. Is that the situation?
You check it every time on the dial site to make sure it doesn't vibrate the others.
And just sitting there squeezing a trigger.
Pull the thing back, press the button. Change the belt. After 10,000 pounds, change the belt and start again. And that's all we did. We just battled away with their services.
Was this the same time that the Chinese put their one attack in on D Company, on 355.
Yes. Yeah, it was all about the same. I don't know where that was after.
Did you get involved in that?
We didn't get involved.
Oh. You must have heard it.
We heard, but we weren't with...
You weren't with D Company, were you?
No, I was with A Company, I think. But, no, you see, the way that we put in position on 355, I was firing straight at 2-2-1. The other guns would be that way, and set that way.
At different angles?
Different angles. So we couldn't get down there if we wanted to, without moving the gun.
But as I said, you would hear this was going in.
And it was repulsed. But we couldn't take any time. The whole, we were all stuck too, because I've been all the way up. We were stuck too anyway. We were fighting on our own targets on everything else. But the rest of the rifle guns were all stuck too that night. And then, for some reason, I don't know what it was. That was all on there when I was second time wounded. And it was after that was happening, and I went down, I didn't hear it was somebody further down the mid section, down the hill, forward. And coming back up, he started the mortars. Myself and then a lad called Robinson, who went into this gun emplacement that wasn't being used. There was another four coming there, and they were just sitting the mortar attack out. And one of them came straight over the opening, and bang, and that was the end of that. And Robinson got a piece of the shrapnel through his chest, and I was hit on the side of the place in the neck. And I remember the first reaction, my reaction was just get out of there and have a look. And I went at the first picture I could see, and there was one of those steel mirrors. And I looked, and I saw it, and I said, oh, well, all right. And I took Robinson and myself, and there was a RAP post, so Air Post, and so many of the corps were there, and they just sent us straight down the patch, you know, put a patch on. Robinson was by that time very weak. They sent him down on the airport, I think. And I walked down, and they put on the back of the jeep,
What date was this?
September 1953.
The Indian Mash, what was the reception there?
The Indian Mash? They used to be a very quiet and very professional. Not like an American Russian girl. Not sophisticated as an American Russian. But very professional. And the big sleep doctor there took the pieces of ball bearing on that place without the scanner. I was very grateful for that.
Was this a number of
yes.
marks on your face?
From the just above the right eye, down the side of the right eye, down the cheek, and down the neck. Peppered with ball bearings. Yeah.
And some had gone into your skin?
Yeah, it had gone through into the cheeks.
How did you get them out?
He took them out of the same hole they got into. He didn't cut. He said he was going to do that, and I'm very grateful because it didn't last out.
You're very fortunate not to get it in the eye.
Yes,
yeah,
so that time I had the tin hat on, and it went under the tin hat and burst to that side of me. And it, you know, I was very lucky to not to get it in the eye. There was a much big dent in the tin hat, obviously. The Robinson was sucking away on the side of me, he got a face right through the middle of his chest.
Was he alright? Did
you
cry?
Yes, he's really good to me since.
So it was an Indian mash, as you say, which was very sedate and presumably quiet hospital. And the treatment, obviously, was good. Were they all Sikhs?
Yes.
A mix, yeah?
Yeah, they were all Sikhs. No females.
All men?
All men. All those large beards and that's frightening. In fact, if you frightened or not, even did the man have your fight, but they weren't really gentle, I mean, they were, but they didn't do any fighting.
And this was the Indian contribution to the Commonwealth, of course.
Very strange to listen to them. I mean, the doctor was the only one that speak English, I mean, but these sick nurses were really, that was certainly as clear, there was not a female, they were all men.
Was it Indian food or
no,
British Army food?
It was American.
And the treatment itself, other than withdrawing the ball bearings, did you have to have injections or?
Yes, I was there for a while, straight back to the battalion.
And what are your memories of this particular time on 355?
Well, he started then to give us a bit of a hammer, with a mortar. And that's it.
You said that their mortaring was pretty good, I think.
It was deadly at times. If they got wind of anything, moving. I was known as Speedy Gonzalo because I'd been to the West French Fashion and everybody else. After the two, twice of that, I think that I got a little bit windy. I said, move fast.
The 355 was a position you couldn't move on freely.
No, you couldn't move on freely at all. You just had to one about in the daytime. You've got to just, I mean, the trench is 8 foot deep on the top. You couldn't see over the top unless you stood on something or something.
And these trenches, were hewn out of the rock, were they, in effect, on the hillside?
Yes, they were probably 4 foot wide by 4 foot deep.
And they'd have a fire step on for
getting fire step on, but we didn't fire from the trenches, not a fire from the trenches, it was just protection on the hill. And they would go probably 10 yards and then turn quickly and then straight up again. They were never
traversed, what they call traversed, yeah.
Yeah, I remember going down once, down and round the corner, and somebody found this, it was always Mongolian, dead Mongolian, and he'd stood in where the valley of the trench was. And he'd obviously been riddled from the groin right up his chest, and there was a single round sticking out of his, just where his fastened his shirt on his leg, collar stuff, and just stood in the trench. And that's a bit of a shock, but down the road here, I can turn the corner and just come face to face with a dead man, you know. But he had nowhere else to come.
He must have smelt a bit.
Oh, it did. We had to dispose of it. We just found it and he searched it for me. And then we were buried. And one of the things I remember on that was we had Korean interpreters for the first time. For the little Korean soldiers that we had, they just developed an interpreter. And so my interpreter.
So he could converse with them now. Were you being informed about what was happening in the war in general?
Yes, Pam and John, we could see from 355, we could see the smoke from the chimney. And it finished by, did you finish by all up there or after it came up? We were getting daily bulletins then. It was close, it was coming in. And we could see this, we couldn't see Pam and John, but we could see the chimney smoke. And that was after the wind, that was where it was going on. And if the chimney smoke during the day, when you had talks going on, if the smoke didn't come up, why didn't you have the talks with us?
So went on quite a long time, didn't they?
Oh, yes. 2 or 3 months. The room was going 2 or 3 months ago.
It must have been difficult for morale to know that you risk being hurt or killed and it could be peace tomorrow.
Oh, yes. I think some of them got anxious about it. It was sort of stalemate because we stopped firing and they stopped shelling and everything went, flat. And then one day we woke up and it was announced that the ceasefire would be. And that's what always amused me about these ceasefires. We were told the day before that the ceasefire will be 11 o'clock tomorrow. And somebody could have been killed in that time. Why couldn't it be a ceasefire if gone now? And it always amused me that the ceasefire was at 11 o'clock tomorrow morning. And we had the fire at night.
Was it before this situation that you got your leave in Japan, Tokyo? Or was it after?
Yes. There was two of us got leave in Tokyo. 10 days in Tokyo. We were flown over from Seoul in a Globemaster, and we get the airplane with 8 engines on the rear side of the wing. First time I ever flown in my life. And I always looked at this plane, and they marched 360 yards on. It was a double decker. We were on the top deck, and it was just a grating floor. And I was looking through the grating, and we had to sit between the struts at the side. And I asked what we were sitting on, he said, "That's your parachute." And there's sort of 180 of us upstairs, 180 downstairs, and one was really great, massive tail, and came out the back tail. Then they drove 3 5-tonners in. And I said, "Why never go to the ground?" I've never flown them, I don't know the capacity of these things.
American plane.
Big American plane. The Globemaster, I don't remember the name of it. Then we took off and we landed in Tokyo. It was a night flight. And then we were taken off in Tokyo. This big building. And how it did that? It was like a big Nazi building. And a massive dining hall. And we were free to go anywhere we liked. To begin the market as a big trail. And it was there, our first day down. It was left all good for you, it was in Darlington, I was in the rail, it wore off. And we went down to the dining room, we sat down with the old woman out, all different veterans. And I was talking away, and Bushfield was to be fascinated. There's a voice behind me saying, "I know you." And a fair number of his men that had emigrated to Australia from Auckland Park, didn't do his name, he should have opened them. He was in the Royal Australian Rifles, and he was on the table behind him. They called him Ward. He knew where I was from, he looked around and said, marvellous, you know, and we spent a week, so 10 years together. And he was at the same field as me. I wanted to get out of Tokyo. So we used to transport everything, both of me, both his temples and the gardens. I think it's a lovely country. We used to go and look at the cookie center. You know, we didn't bother with Tokyo in itself. Apart from we met this Japanese student. And he was studying English. And he invited us back to his parents' house. And we went for tea one day. And that was a film day street. Going to the Japanese, we saw the middle class house. And he took his shoes off at the door. And he put the shoe in. And then he stepped up onto the straw mat in front. And there's no furniture, just cushions and a little table. And it was a traditional Japanese house. The beds were just sort of in the walls and just came down at night. And he sat on cushions. There's charcoal burning in the middle of the floor for heat. It was a good experience, though.
Were the Japanese friendly, those people you didn't meet?
Yes, very friendly. We didn't meet many, apart from the student. And when we got out into the country, we used to meet the people out there. And
they weren't anti-American or anti-British.
They weren't anti-British. I don't know about them, but they weren't anti-British.
The building that you say you went into, the Naffy type building, were they individual rooms?
No, there was probably four in the room. But it was a bed and sheets. We went into that. Bed sheets, you were fed. If you went down to the food, you'd get fed. If you didn't go, you didn't get fed. There was a bar. It was just a massive, great building.
Had you got new uniforms issued and cleaned up and things of that nature?
You didn't take your name, because if you stored that with the full sergeant before you left, and you just had your uniform, your cleaning gear, and that was a spare pair of underpants.
And you say that you didn't spend it in the big cities, you got
out. I went to the Ginza Market, and I walked up some of the main streets, but otherwise I spent my time out. The one of the things I got on was a bullet train. I went to all 50 miles in a bullet train, and that was an experience. But I enjoyed the countryside. I wanted to go.
Well, the city must have been geared to troops and in many ways. Yeah, you know, women and what have you.
Prostitution. The cinemas were all right, but then again, they didn't show anything that we were interested in. You know, say the market was all right. Having a look at Turkey, we looked at the catacombs where there's 22,000. After the big earthquake, went down to the catacombs and I looked at that. But one of the things I do when I was riding a taxi in Tokyo, I never do it again. None of it's the same, is it?
It's traffic.
Traffic. They don't care which side of the road is traffic. The taxi we got, if you go somewhere, I forget now where we're going, we've got this taxi. And he just got himself in the middle of the road and just headed straight down. And there was things flying towards him. And he just kept moving.
Was there any war damage still showing?
They were pretty well. By Tokyo, I don't think there's damage to be at. We went up to see Hiroshima, and that was terrible. We did go up there, and that, I'll never forget that. I mean, in 1953.
In what way was it terrible?
Well, there was nothing there. There was just twisted steel and a few concrete blocks. And that's it. You look across this city as big as Newcastle, and all you could see was twisted steel and concrete blocks.
They hadn't rebuilt it at that
time. And then just outside, there was a museum.